Rewinding Kaya FM on FM Rewind.
The Law Report with Michael Matwening Bell, Kaya FM 95.9.
We continue on the same theme as Dr. Cindy Fonsale, and we continue the discussion talking about gender-based violence. I mean, this is something that plagues our society, and by the looks of things, seems as if it'll plague our society for some time to come still. So, as citizens of the country, as people who are affected by this in one way or another, and certainly as people who perpetrate this act, let's have a conversation tonight and talk about, you know, what is the end? When is the end? How do we get to the end? You know, what leads us to do these things to other people? But also for those that are the receiving end, what leads us to not report when these things happen? So let's have that engagement, because I think the difficulty is often, or more often, we don't get to hear the voice of, I'm the one that does this and this is why I've done it. And we don't get to hear the voice of the one that says, well, this has happened to me, but I haven't reported it because their names don't feature in the statistics. Let's have a discussion about gender-based violence and how we can, you know, better understand this animal that we are wrestling with. Do give me a call, as always. Number to dial, 086-000-959. And thank you so much for Dr. Cindy Fonsale. She's back after this.
Know your rights. Know the law. The Law Report with Michael Matwening Bill.
All right, GBV. I mean, it's become such a well-known acronym. Certainly, I didn't know it 4 years ago even. And now it's something that, you know, I don't even have to wonder what one is talking about when one says GBV. And it's gender-based violence, because it's something that, you know, our women and children are subjected to almost in an unrelenting way. And I want to talk about, you know, what is it that makes us specifically susceptible as a society to this issue? And why are we amongst the highest ranking countries? Helping me to understand some of these issues are none other than Rami Chwena, whom you know very well as an actress and Isona star. Rami, good evening, and thank you very much for talking to me this evening.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Good to be talking to you.
Hello to the listeners.
Yes, indeed. I said to myself, I had to tell you that I look forward to talking to you because you are, you are a rare occasion for me. Also, Lindsay Henson, lawyers against abuse. Lindsay, thank you very much for talking to me. Are you well?
Hi, Michael. I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
As well as Fisani Masangu from NSM. SA. Welcome to you, Fisani. Are you well?
Yes, I'm well. And how are you doing?
I'm great indeed. Thank you for asking. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about gender-based violence and with my guest. And we want to get some of your thoughts, some of your questions, if you will, around this issue. And do give us a call. Number to dial 086-000-959. Fisani, perhaps let me start with you and talk about, you know, your organization and what it seeks to do, and maybe, you know, there's something that I read about what you guys are doing, and maybe talk to us about that once you've introduced your organization.
Okay. My name is Fisani Masangu, and I'm here today representing the National Shelter Movement of South Africa, which is an organization registered as a non-profit organization that seeks to be a united voice on sheltering for women and children affected by gender-based violence in South Africa. So our strongest activism point is on issues of gender-based violence, and more especially on sheltering and ensuring that there are safe spaces for women and children who have experienced domestic violence and other kinds of abuse.
And let me pick up on something that I particularly found interesting, and you have established a 24-hour hotline. Talk to us about that, because I think many would agree that this is something that many of us have hoped and wished for, and I thought what you have done is quite interesting, but also, well, much needed, a much needed service for women and children.
Yes, just yesterday on the 1st of December, many would know that it was World AIDS Day, but the National Shelter Movement also took an opportunity to officially launch the National Shelter helpline, and it is a toll-free helpline.
Mm.
And so on this helpline, anybody in the country can actually call and be directed to a nearest, safest shelter closest to them. So today at 8 a.m. in the morning, the lines were going live. So it means if you can call right now and you're looking for a shelter, you'll be directed to where you can find the nearest shelter.
So if I need a place to stay and I'm a victim of abuse, I can call you and say, this is where I am. I'm based in Tembisa, or I'm based in Pimville. Who can accommodate me right now?
Yes, you'll be directed.
And I think that's very good. And I'm going to ask you to just share the number with us, and perhaps we'll do the same thing again at the close of the show. If you can just share how one accesses this 24-hour toll-free shelter hotline.
Yes, or one can actually call 0800-001-005. I'll repeat the number again. The toll-free number is 0800-001-005. And we also have got WhatsApp, three WhatsApp numbers, and you can find us on WhatsApp, or please call me on 082-057-8600. I'll repeat the number again, 082-057-8600. But we've got three of these numbers that I'll be sharing as we proceed.
Lindsay, if I could just bring you in here. Thank you very much for that, Fafisani. If I could just bring you in here, I mean, you're lawyers against abuse, and one wishes services such as yours were not necessary, but they are in fact quite necessary. I just wanted to, you know, maybe just touch on something that a lot of people often voice views on, and that is the adequacy of our law in this country. And is that sort of where the problem is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big question. So in terms of the adequacy of the law, so the laws in South Africa around gender-based violence are actually very strong relative to other countries. They're very victim-centric. They're very expansive. And the real issue, I would say, comes down to the implementation of those laws. And as a result of that, the way that the law is experienced by victims of violence in communities and on the ground is actually very different than the way that the law is written on paper. So, I mean, when we have, I mean, even now, there are three new, you know, gender-based violence or three new pieces of legislation related to gender-based violence being considered in Parliament. And again, it's not that there's necessarily anything wrong with that, but again, just putting more laws on paper without actually dealing with implementation issues and the lack thereof, and actually holding state actors accountable for the implementation of those laws isn't actually going to benefit the, you know, the victim in the community on the ground.
Rami, if I could bring you in here, and I think that although there are many reasons why we would have had you on the show talking about this issue, including your book, but more recently you tweeted about this topic in reaction to the president's a speech. Maybe just share with us what your sense was on sort of the political expression given by the president of South Africa versus what your views are.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting that, you know, you've got the two ladies in as well as part of the conversation, because they're on point with everything that they're saying. Mm. That, you know, the law based on the law that we have in South Africa, women and children are not properly protected. And not only that, it's also, even though the laws are strong, but people on the ground do not necessarily have access, and they do not have the know-how. So I'm not anti 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, but I'm saying that the 16 days should be used as a tool, as awareness, to remind people to go out and do outreach and just basically take the word out there. But the work should be done around all year round. And you can see that work is not being done by the facilities that we have. You know, thank God for the for organizations like the shelters that Susan is part of. That, because people do not have access. You go to the police station, the protocol is not properly followed. The police are not well equipped. So they don't deal with these things on the ground. So it is even difficult to now have to go through something in the court of law if the little basic steps have not been taken care of. So I'm saying the awareness should be all year round and people should be reached all over the place, because that's one of the reasons why people stay in abusive relationships, abusive marriages. But we need to empower our people to a point that they know that it is okay for them to reach out, and when they reach out, they will still be protected.
You've said quite a number of things that I wanted to pick on, and I hope to do so during the course of the show. But one thing that I want to play before I engage you further, Rami, is what the president said. I want us to just listen to this.
We know that we are in a crisis, and that this crisis demands we step up measures to protect women and girls and advance their interests and their rights. The national strategic plan that was crafted by the women of our country guides the effort to combat gender-based violence and femicide. Since the start of this year, we've been moving ahead with the implementation in key areas. Firstly, with regard to the care and the support that our nation must give to the survivors of gender-based violence. Secondly, the education, but more importantly, the prevention steps that must be taken to prevent gender-based violence. And thirdly, how we can enhance legal and policy frameworks that will guide the change of attitude in our nation. And fourthly, strengthening the criminal justice system, and also the most important, not that the others are not important, how we enhance the economic empowerment of the women of our country.
I mean,
yeah,
it's everything is pointed and we'll touch on each of them, but one that is possibly unfathomable for me is one of the attitude that President Ramaphosa alludes to, where I think it's okay for me to lay a hand on a woman, let alone a human being. I mean, it's a whole human being, a whole adult human being. And in fact, I say adult. I don't know why I say that, because even the Constitutional Court said even your children are not supposed to be hit by you. And doing so is a criminal offense. So what is it that, you know, our attitude that makes us think that it's permissible and it's okay and we are justified to do that? And how do we overcome that? Because the irony of this is the very men that do this were born of women, and yet they do this to other women. So the psychology of it all is just bewildering. I'm not sure whether there is sort of any kind of thoughts around, you know, how we repair the attitude, or not even repair, but more get the attitude of men to be right, such that we don't think that it's okay. Rami?
Yeah. Hmm? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You're so right, because I think one of the things that has hindered the process or the progress of minimizing or taking the statistics down for gender-based violence is that we always talk about reaction measures, you know, what women must not do. This is what you must do not to provoke. This is what you must not wear. This is what you must not say. So we're busy reacting instead of being proactive. We should be dealing with men to be able, so that they are educated, they are principles are instilled, manners, etiquette, behavioral changes, all of that. It starts with them first, you know?
Yes.
Because me as a victim, I have no power, I have no say. If you as the perpetrator do not see me as someone who's vulnerable and you don't have the sense that you shouldn't be laying a hand on me. So we shouldn't be dealing with the people, with how the victims should react to avoid being abused. Instead, we should be dealing with abusers themselves. So that's where we need to start. And it starts at home. It's at school. It is at, you know, at gatherings. Men, when they're together, what is it that they talk about?
Yes.
How do they uplift each other? How do they encourage one another? How do they, you know, instill values and respect and their sense of pride to say, this is who we are. And if we don't fix what we are, the world will never be enough. It will never be okay. So the whole mentality of saying what women and children should do or not do, I think it's actually a very regressive way of dealing with it. It's not a positive way of working with it. We should start with the perpetrators and allow the victims to heal by themselves, but it starts with the men themselves.
One of the other things, Fisani, that the president mentioned is economics in the whole spectrum of things, where generally speaking, men are better off than women for historical reasons, none other than just historical reasons. And to what extent does economics or financial muscle help further further and deepen the issues that we confront?
It's an important point, as the president said, and he even said that it doesn't mean that all the others that you mentioned are not important, but I think there's a realization and an agreement that the economics, as you're saying, and the financial status of different genders in society also plays a part in gender-based violence and femicide in the country and everywhere else. And it's not just only in South Africa, but I think across the board, across worldwide. It is a fact, I would call it, that women and girls have lesser opportunities when compared to the male counterpart. As a result, we find that even in situations where we find that there's gender-based violence in a certain home or between a couple, it becomes a situation where, in some instances, the partner, the female partner, is dependent on this man. And that sometimes becomes even the source of abuse, because we find that this woman and the children are deprived of food and other basic necessities by a person who is actually supposed to be providing. In some instances, we find that even if the source of abuse is not the finances or the economics, but a woman will still hang on to the relationship because she's thinking, where am I going to go if I leave this relationship? Because my sole provider is this person who is able to buy bread and meal me for her. So economic empowerment can be and plays a huge role in ensuring that gender-based violence and femicide is lessened. Because if a woman knows that even if I leave this situation, I'll be empowered to be able to stand on my own and support myself and my children, she'll have the courage to get out of a relationship where she feels there is abuse. Because it doesn't just become so ugly in one day, but the person will see the sign. But then other factors, including economic and financial status of a person, keeps that person in that relationship. So it is very important. And it doesn't only end when the woman is still in the relationship that they are dependent on this, but even when they get out of the relationship where there is abuse, there is a need for different departments and stakeholders to come together and realize that women need to be empowered. It can be at the municipal level, it can be in shelters, it can be at the Department of Labor, Department of Trade and Industry. A lot of partners here can come to a table and play a part in ensuring that women, especially those who have access to shelters, are empowered with skills to enable themselves to stand on their own. I'll share with you, yesterday when we were launching the helpline, there was a lady, Leanne. She was once in a shelter. She was a victim of domestic violence. And luckily she survived, and she went to a shelter where she received economic empowerment. And when she was sharing, she shared that it is very important that she is where she is now because of the skills that she was given and the opportunities. Because at some stage they have to exit shelters. But when you exit a shelter where you are provided with basic necessities, if you do not have skills and if you do not have anything to enable you to go and look for a job, what do you do afterwards? Some end up returning to those situations again, even after undergoing empowerment, other kinds of empowerment in shelters. So yes, economic empowerment is very important.
It sounds so indeed. But when we come back, I want to sort of explore, still on the same theme, a question to the effect that, you know, abuse is not only in relation to the economically weak. Even strong women are abused. Even financially independent and executive women are abused. And yet they could have sit in the same room and share their emotions. I think there are some complexities which I hope we can discuss and perhaps get some enlightenment on. But before doing so, let me take a break and we'll continue this chat when we come back.
Know your rights, know the law. The Law Report with Michael Matswining Bill.
Welcome back. I'm continuing my conversation. I'm talking to Rami Chwena, whom you know very well, Fisani Masangu, as well as Lindsay Henson, the latter being a lawyer at Lawyers Against Abuse, and Fisani with NSMSA. We explored before the break this issue of financial ability versus abuse and sexual violence. How does it play out in respect of women that are potentially doing better than their counterparts? And in fact, arguably, some would argue that, in fact, even some women get abused precisely because they are financially more independent and powerful. Anybody, jump in.
Well, that is true. I agree. In fact, that was going to be one of my points, that not only do women who are financially dependent on men be abused, but sometimes you are abused because you are more financially independent. And when we speak abuse, not only are we talking physical abuse, but emotional abuse. You know, when now you can't even go anywhere. Oh, why are you dressed like that? Who are you going to meet? Is that because you're making more money than I do? Because I'm sitting at home, I'm not earning money. Now you're seeing better people. You're seeing better guys. So you end up, you know, it's your self-esteem being attacked constantly. It is your confidence being knocked each time, and those kind of things. And you find that by the time it gets to a point of no return, the mental state of women, of the woman, is so damaged that they don't see a way out. And they also, you end up you're also very sympathetic beings, so you also think, if I leave, what is it going to live on? But they do it so well. The manipulation gaming is done so expertly that you end up being trapped because of, you know, you're trapped by your own fear. What if I leave, he kills me? What if I stay, he kills me? Like, you don't even know what to do. But sometimes with people who are abusive perpetrators, their mental intellect and how they know how to manipulate their victims, they do it in such a way that you don't see a way out except to stick with them until they decide when to let you go, whether by death or by just leaving you alone.
Or leaving you when they've taken everything away from you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Lindsay, your thoughts. I mean, these issues are complex, are diverse, and they present in many shapes and forms. To say, what is that thing that keeps us, that brings us back to the very thing that hurts us? Because you know, to what extent does even love
Yeah.
send us right back to hurt?
Right. I mean, I agree with all the things that have been said so far. I would just add that, you know, especially if we're looking at intimate partner violence as a particular type of gender-based violence, you know, it is something that cuts across race, nationality, socioeconomic status, education levels. I think there's often this perception, you know, that victims of, you know, victims of domestic violence or intimate partner violence is, you know, it is a situation of financial dependence, and that certainly is, you know, in a lot of the cases, and it is one of the primary reasons, as Sunny has said, that women don't feel like they're able to leave a relationship, an abusive relationship. You know, but there are other reasons, as have been mentioned already, and a big one is around fear, you know, a fear of a perpetrator. So, you know, that they actually condition their victim over time to say, you know, if I can't have you, no one can have you, you know, so this mentality. And we know, you know, according, there's been research that a woman is in the most danger immediately after she leaves an abusive relationship, because we know that abuse is all about power. And by leaving, that's, you know, taking away, that's kind of the final act of taking away that power from a perpetrator. There's also fear around just not being believed. As was stated, often these perpetrators are masters in manipulation. So, you know, there's a completely different picture that's being presented to the outside world than is actually what's happening at home behind closed doors. And so because of that, you know, the victim has seen how this perpetrator has, you know, manipulated friends, family, you know, everybody else that is completely unaware that this is going on. And she's afraid that, you know, if I say that this is happening and I reach out for support, like, who's going to believe me? They're all going to believe this, like, shiny picture that he's put forward. I think, as you said, you know, the love element, you know, I think people are desperately, in some situations, they're desperately hoping that their partner will change. And what, you know, what is a, you know, a commonly studied phenomenon is what we call the cycle of abuse. Or the cycle of violence, where, you know, you have an incident, and then you have, you know, and then after an incident, then there is an apology phase, and then there's a honeymoon phase where, you know, I promise I'll never do it again, I'm so sorry, you know, and then from there, you have tension building again until another incident. And what you see over time is this cycle repeats itself again and again and again. And often victims won't even identify it necessarily as a cycle until somebody educates them about it. And what you see often is that not only does the cycle repeat itself, but the incidents become more and more severe in nature, and the length of the cycle from beginning to end also begins to shorten over time. And so whereas, you know, something starts off as, you know, maybe something like verbal abuse, you know, then to a slap or a push, you know, all the way escalating to, you know, being choking or other forms, more severe forms of violence. And it may also be, you know, in terms of frequency of an incident, it may be in the beginning, it happens once a year, and then, you know, and then it's every few months, and then it's every week, and then it's potentially daily. And it can be, it get into the point until a woman realizes, like, actually, you know, if I stay, he is going to kill me. And that's when they finally realize that they have to leave.
I want to put a question, and it could, it's one that I've had to reflect on, both in terms of how I pitch it, but also the thought itself, which is, when women get abused within the context of a family by a husband with whom she may or may not have children with, we always look at it as an act of weakness, or why is she going back? But is it possible that it is in fact an act of love and heroism to do so? Because it's love of family, it's love of structure, it's love of children, it's love of hope, it's love of the man, it's love is hope in change, hope in it being better. So oftentimes that when one hopes, one may not necessarily be a fool or the fool, but simply the hero, because it is the hero that tries, even at their own peril, to keep the family going, to keep the structure going, to keep the life going. And I wonder sometimes whether those women that have endured, some of whom have been described as, I don't know why Ugogo tolerated that man, whether they actually create, whether they sacrifice something so profound, their own happiness, so that you can have a gogo, an AIM cool, an A, some kind of a structure where it's together. Because I think I wonder whether as we talk about these victims, we are neglecting the question of their heroism.
Can I jump in there?
Yes, please.
Yes, I think I hear you very well, the point that you are bringing. And it's true, maybe we may be overlooking the other side of it, as we are calling it heroism. But I think it is maybe worth celebrating that there are some women who endure and they stay up until, as you're saying, the children will say, I had a mom and a dad under one roof. And some kids will say, we had our grandfather and our grandmom still together. Even they point and say, that is my grandmom and that is my grandfather. But we also have to look at the other side of it,
yes,
of this woman or this man staying in this kind of a relationship where abuse is a norm. You should also look at what is it that you are socializing the people that you are raising into. This is where we find that, remember, behaviors are learned. So when children are in a household that is full of a battering, that is full of insults, there's emotional abuse, there's torture. You know, when this man comes into the house, the woman has to just stop whatever she has been doing. If she was watching her favorite story on TV, they were laughing in the house, everything has to stop suddenly.
Yes.
But she continues to enjoy that. We have to look at the products that are going to come out of such a home. It then perpetuates this cycle where even the boy child who's raised in his household will go out and become like the man that he learned from.
Yes.
And when I walk into my gate, my children should just disappear or they should just straighten up. And the girl who's raised in such a home is also going to be the same girl who's also going to enjoy as a grandmom and as a mom enjoyed the abuse. So yes, I hear you very well when you're saying it can be heroism. We have to maybe just at least celebrate this, but there's another side to it. Behaviors are learned. And in a family setting, when people are a family, so they socialize and they raise human beings for future generations. So what knowledge will be passed on to these children for future?
Can I just jump in there and just completely agree with what Sifan is saying, because this whole heroism thing that women do, it's something that has been, it's a lot of pressure. Because don't forget that we live in a very, there's so much patriarchy in our society, especially in Africa, that, you know, the man is the head, whatever they say goes, you know. So the same thing that you're watching your favorite TV show, and when the husband comes back, home, you jump.
You switch off Isono.
And you know, next thing you have to jump up, switch off the TV, and go to your favorite channel, you know, piece the chicken together because now he's back. And, you know, it's all those things. The manner, those mannerisms, those behaviors, they can be changed. And it's up to us to change and say, this was the way they used to do things. And we know that the way these things were done, it is not the right way. It is literally abusing someone else. It is infringing on someone else's human rights. You know, we can change this kind of behaviors. We are trying to now raise people or young people who can think freely, who are forward thinkers, who are world changers. And some of these laws that our grandfathers, our parents, our great-grandfathers ruled with or were ruled by are now so out of place with where the world is going. And we can never be better if we go back and stick to some of those rules that even, you know, law is law, that in terms of like traditional law is traditional law. It doesn't work like that anymore. Right now, we want to raise children in love and not in fear. We're trying to instill freedom that has order instead of a law that has order. You know, we're trying to break those kind of chains and say we are able to live together freely, respecting one another, and also, you know, and live peacefully. but those laws can be reversed. Those things that our grandparents have been living by, those principles, oh, we need to unlearn them as quickly as possible. And I think that can help us, you know, going forward.
Do we not live in a dual society in a way?
And one which
could create almost or contribute to this problem, because on the one hand, we are very clear that South Africa is a patriarchal society and that is not acceptable. And yet we say that the man is the head of the household, and we then go on and filter that down, that Ubaba Ute versus Ubaba's word in the household, and how that translates in the ear of a young boy. And I know that, you know, so I wonder whether the reflection, how far can the reflection go where Ubaba's word is final, or Ubaba says, well, I'm the bull in this kraal, and Mama's voice is subservient to that of Papa in the house. Should we perhaps open that discussion insofar as, you know, because a lot of people do say, oh yeah, it's 50-50, but it doesn't really translate into 50-50 within the household. And yet we accept that. In fact, when we marry off our women, our girls, who are to become women, we say to them, you know, laleli ndoda, uzthobe, and submit, and all of those nice things. And I'm not necessarily voicing out a personal view, because there might naturally be a conflict between the question and my personal views, but I'm voicing it to put it out there to say what discussion should we be having? Are we in a dual society and in denial thereof?
And I would just add one other thing, and not only that, but if we even look at the way, not only the way it filters down from the top and the head of the household, but looking at just the inequitable way that boy children and girl children are treated and they're raised growing up, and what are the standards that are placed on them from a young age in terms of their role within the family. So in terms of a girl child being responsible for, you know, maybe additional house chores, whereas a boy child is then free to play, or different standards about, you know, when a girl child must be home, but a boy child can stay late, and, you know, characteristics that are celebrated in one gender, but then, you know, criticized in another gender. So I think that's also a key piece of it, and that's, you know, in terms of the double standard that we're creating in our homes from an early age.
And I think it perhaps does force us to reflect, because, I mean, if you take a girl child, when a girl child gives water to the father, she hits a knee, and yet the boy child need not. In fact, need not even give him water when there is a girl child in the house. And yes, we've celebrated that as respect, and perhaps we should still, but should we then also then, if we do celebrate it, not recognize this duality of perceptions where we want that same girl child that hit a knee to then talk to to be a CEO one day and talk to the chairperson and hit the metaphorical knee. I want to probe this really, but time dictates that I take a break. When I come back, we'll talk about it further.
The Law Report with Michael Matwening Bell, Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back. I continue my discussion. I'm talking to Rami Chwene, Fisani Matlang, as well as Lindsay Henson. And we're talking about this issue of GBV. And of course we have many ambitions, but none of them include solving the problem of GBV, but certainly exploring what could be the causes of it and you know what the path is to solving it at a minimum. And before we took a break, I mean, one of the things, I mean, I talking about our culture where we were taught not to look at the elder people in the eyes when we're speaking to them, and you got to look down. And I know that it doesn't apply to those of us who grew up in the township, but certainly those that grew up in rural areas, that's what they were taught. And for some reason, we were able to be very clear that once we got to corporate, we knew that that was not acceptable, and we learned to look at elders, leaders, superiors dead in the eye, because that was what was culturally necessary within the workplace. And therefore, there was a clear distinction between what is culturally necessary in the workplace versus what is culturally necessary in the domestic space. And what I'm trying to explore is, as regards issues of gender, and the example I've just given now is it applies irrespective of gender. It applies equally to male and female. But as regard to gender, are there clear sort of distinctions of, yes, I'm now in the workplace, and yes, I'm female, but when you shake my hand, don't linger. Don't let your other finger linger, and don't let the hug linger for too long, or don't drop the hand. You know, are we as clear as rigid as that, where we can really start to have conversations around even the small nuances that apply either in the workplace or outside of the home environment?
Well, I think there's actually a very thin line when it comes to that. And when I say thin line, it's because of what we've been indoctrinated to think like that, because it has been going for such a long time. And to be quite honest, it will take a lot of work, a lot of effort, and quite some time for us to unlearn that. Because as much as I'm so outspoken, so the kind of person that I am, at the back of my mind, I still remember those kind of things. You know, when you see your dad, you know, even your handshake must support it with the other hand, you know, to say hello, and you can't just walk away when they're talking to you. Those kind of things, they're still there at the back of your mind, because it's such a properly placed doctrine. But then also at the workplace now, we're dealing, as women, not only are we dealing with the so-called patriarchy, but we're also dealing with sexual harassment. How long can your hug linger? Mm. You know, I don't want to, because if I allow you to touch me for quite some time, you might start getting wrong ideas. Mm. So we are dealing with two problems that are, you know, they're moving concurrently, even though they're like kind of separated. But it's like, you know, we deal with so many things and juggling so many balls when it comes to our behavior, when it comes to how the men perceive us, and then we deal with patriarchy, we're dealing with abuse. Women have a lot of things to deal with and to think about. So you don't know, you don't want to be disrespectful, and yet you don't want someone to invade your space. And it's such a big touch and go, man. It is such a lot to deal with.
Okay, can I ask this? I mean, do we have a profile of the kind of man that would be abusive or would commit acts of gender-based violence? And I ask this because part of the answers that were coming out, and particularly from you, Fisani, where you're saying, do you want your children to witness that growing up? So I'm wondering in my head, because I'm trying to imagine what a 9-year-old, 10-year-old would think of a man beating his mother, and I have no doubt that they would be incensed by the idea. And I'm also then wondering whether that same 9-year-old, having been incensed, would 15 years down the line think that it's okay. And I'm also then thinking about another 9-year-old who then grows up to be 25 years old, never seen GBV in his life, being either perpetrated by in his household or anywhere, and then suddenly almost invents this thing or becomes a pioneer within his own context. I'm wondering whether we have a profile of who is likely to be the committer of, you know, a perpetrator of gender-based violence, or is it more, you know, somebody, you know, when you look, comparatively speaking, countries like South Africa, Brazil, which are all developing in nature, are top. Are those men who sort of battle with financial security and confidence and egos, I guess? What do we have a profile?
No.
I also agree. We do not have it. It can be anyone. You know what? Let me just, Michael, share this with you, because I've been in the sector. I've seen quite a number of, surprised. I would call them surprising. What I've seen is actually surprising.
Yeah.
You know, gender-based violence is caused by, even ill health can cause gender-based violence.
Right.
And on this one, I want to support, because I want to support my answer where I say, I think Rami or is it Lindsay or Rami will say no also. So I want to support my no with an example.
Yes.
I think it is back, maybe it's now 5 years back. A woman came to me to report, I was working in a shelter at that time. She came to report that she's experiencing gender-based domestic violence in her household. And when I listened to her, it was extreme. To an extent that every day when she goes to work, she uses a public taxi. The husband would be outside of their home, looking at the taxi that she's going to board. And then when she comes back from work, she's obviously going to use another taxi. And when she gets into the house, this woman will be called all names, you're a prostitute, you know, all those languages that you can imagine, all these words. And you know what was the cause of this? The man became diabetic.
Okay.
Yes. He became, all along, the marriage was okay. He was working, he was okay. Everything was moving on so well.
Right.
So this woman, she says, my husband has become diabetic. And it has affected his sexuality in the house. So, I think because he's unable to imagine himself not being able to satisfy his wife. So the fact that the wife has to meet different men and interact with different men, starting from a text, you can just imagine you're getting, every day you use a different text. There's no way you can always have that one text with you public. It is different. So it simply means all these men are now her boyfriend.
Yes.
That is his thought. So I'm supporting my answer to say anyone can become abusive. It depends on the situation and on the trigger. So we cannot say we have a profile. And you know, with violence, there are so many contributing factors. Others will grow up like well-groomed children, and then in their adult years, they begin to use alcohol, and they fail to control themselves after too much intake of alcohol. And they get home, they become abusive. Others, I don't know, maybe it is, you just say that insecurity. They feel that maybe this woman is earning more, or she's maybe always away from home. She has this business trip and everything. Then jealousy comes in. They become abusive. So we do not have a fitting profile to say these kinds of boys will grow up to become abusive. Or these kind of men who work in a certain sector will be abusive. We cannot say that. But it depends on different circumstances at a given time.
And also the sense of entitlement as well, because now it's like, if I can't have you, no one else will. And that is something that a lot of men deal with, and they have issues with, and that's where the jealousy stems from, the insecurity, that's where it stems from. So yes, I would also like to support my statement to say we do not have a profile, but not with an example, but saying what I would still like to see is that because we do not have a profile, we shouldn't stop teaching and stop making people aware, because, you know, you cast a very wide net. Because you don't know who you're speaking to. Abuse, gender-based violence doesn't have a face. You don't see someone does that physically looking at them and say, this one looks like that person. So we just need to teach our boys and our men that. Be the person that, like, I would like a man that I don't want to be scared of. And I would like to have a man that would conduct himself in a way that he knows that just me looking at him, I'll be confident enough to know that he will never lay a hand on me. He will never verbally abuse me. He will never financially, deprive me. But not because of what I have done, but basically because of the work that he chose to do for himself and on himself.
And if I could just jump in quickly before we
go on to another topic. I would agree with the things that have been said so far, but I would also say that there is research and research done in South Africa about looking at what are some of the, you know, there's certainly not causal factors, but what are some of the contributing factors or some of the, you know, correlating factors that we see in terms of perpetration of violence. Because I think it's really useful to understand that in terms of thinking about then how can we address it. And some of the things that have been identified in the research are things like, you know, experiences of childhood trauma, experiences of adulthood trauma, things like substance abuse, things like mental health. And so we know that each of these factors then positively correlates with a likelihood to commit violence. And so if we can understand some of those things, then our interventions can be more strategically targeted at addressing and trying to eliminate some of those factors as well.
But I mean, it's often very difficult to understand, because when you talk, I'm aware that you were very careful in saying they're not the causes, certainly, but they are contributory factors. And let's take mental state, for example. One psychologist or one leader in psychology says the following about that very issue. He says that in between stimulus and actions is a gap, and that gap is decision. So if your stimulus is alcohol, or your stimulus is mental health issue, or whatever the choice is, in between that and the ultimate decision that you take the ultimate action that you take is a decision. And that's why in law, if you beat someone up and say, "I was drunk," or you kill someone and says, "I was drunk," we don't accept it as a defense.
Sure.
And I wonder how one then deals with that, the fact that person, despite their mental ill health, despite the inducement from alcohol to drugs, in between that stimulus and the action was a decision. How then do we take that? Because, and I say this because this is a part of accountability. How then do you take that, understanding that these are the contributory factors? What do you use with that? What do you use that information and knowledge for, Lindsay? I'm not sure if you've had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly am not suggesting that it removes accountability and culpability for a person's actions. I would just say then, if we look at, in the community where we work, there was an assessment that was done looking at things like, almost like a community mapping exercise, looking at things like the number of shebeens versus the number of, like, I don't know how they even call the research team called them, but like other positive spaces. So green spaces, parks, libraries, those sorts of things,
yeah.
You know, and you'll see then obviously, the ratio is, you know, it's outrageous. And so thinking about things like looking at, you know, regulations around the alcohol industry, cracking down on things like illegal, you know, just basically reducing availability of those things.
Sure.
Looking at things like mental health, right? So looking at the availability and accessibility of mental health services. And I mean, at the moment, that mostly are provided by NGOs, and there aren't enough. And especially if we look at the history of South Africa and what people, you know, have experienced over the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and all of that then compounded trauma that people aren't able to actually engage with and deal with, and it's manifesting in all of these ways and producing a lot of violence. I mean, you know, South Africa is gender-based violence isn't the only issue, right? We have one of the highest murder rates in the world as well. Mm. And so we are just a violent society overall. And I mean, all of these things, obviously I'm really oversimplifying a very complex issue. But all of these things are then things that we need to be aware of. And as we're thinking about, well, what are additional resources that can be provided? Things like around mental health, things like addressing substance abuse, rehab centers for people who want to actually get clean or actually get sober. Are there services available to support people who identify that this is a problem and they know that this is, as you said, like a trigger or something that's contributing? They want to take a positive action in their lives, but there aren't actually facilities available to help them in doing that, right?
So it's more like that discussion around environment is everything. Because if you are in an environment that's green and it's got a park where you can take a walk and a jog and you have access to help when you need it, you probably turn out to be a better human being, I guess. And that's the point, yeah. And I think it makes perfect sense, Lindsay.
But not again, not removing kind of accountability or culpability. People are responsible for their actions, and there have to be consequences.
Ultimately,
sure.
Indeed. Ladies, wow, thank you.
Yeah.
Rami, thank you. Thank you so much. Fisani and Lindsay, thank you very much, ladies. I'm really indebted to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
And to you, the Afropolitan, thank you very much. I trust that you've enjoyed that as much as I have, but certainly more importantly, I trust that you've learned as much as I have. For me, Michael Mutoning Bill, I'm back again next Wednesday. Good night.
Rewinding Kaya FM on FM Rewind. Visit kayafm.co.za for more.